Welcome into this Golf Channel podcast. I'm your host, Will Gray. Happy to be joined live at Royal Birkdale by Colin Montgomery, World Golf Hall of Famer, victorious Ryder Cup captain.
Well, I apologize for that on behalf of all the American listeners.
It's okay. That team didn't deserve to lift the trophy, so the better team won that day. I'll be happy to say it. I think between the two of us, we have 8 orders of merit, correct?
I think we do. Between the two of us, we do. We have 8. Yes, and between the two of us, we don't have a major either.
Well, that's all right. We're both learning to cope with that as we see fit. But thank you for joining us here. We're talking in the midst of the first round of the Open Championship at Royal Birkdale. So I guess let's start with the venue. This is a place where you have played 3 times in the Open before.
Yes.
What do players expect, or what do you see out of this course that maybe makes it different or unique out of the Open Rota?
I think this is, as everyone says, I think I speak on behalf of 156 players here, this is the fairest test of all. Very little blind shots. You get what you're given. A bad shot is penalised. A good shot is rewarded. And I think that's what the players want. The greens are fairly flat. There's a bit of slope in them, but they're fairly flat overall. So there's not great slopes and hills and hillocks on the greens. So overall, it's by far the best course in England on our rota. And along with Turnberry, has the most character of any of our 9 open rota courses.
What then makes it such a difficult challenge? You say it's a fair course, but then we see 3-over-1 in 2008, even par wins in 1998, so it may be fair, but it's certainly not easy.
Oh no, I never said it was easy. I never said it was easy. I mean, fair. Fair is something where what you mean is that you know, there's no crazy 520-yard par fours. There's no crazy 250-yard par threes.
So Mike Davis is not coming for a site visit anytime soon.
Mike's not in charge. But at the same time, it's just a very, very good test of golf. The pin locations are such that 20 foot is sometimes a good shot into these greens. You've got to play safe. There's a best way around here. And sometimes, yes, you can attack when if you fade the ball, the pin's on the right. Yeah, go for it. But a majority of the time you're playing, I wouldn't say away from the holes, but certainly in a course management sense, playing percentages into the middle of the greens. And therefore, that's why you find Jordan Spieth even doing well today, because 20 foot's a good shot. He's the best putter from 20 foot. And hey presto, as we speak, he's on top of the leaderboard.
There you go. There's always a little bit of an identity crisis for the Open when it comes to the American audience. So many people get up early in the morning, set an extra pot of coffee, and watch the golf. But what, from an American perspective, what are fans missing, or what doesn't translate on TV for an American audience about this tournament?
I think the Open Championship is a lot to do with the weather. And we play on these links courses, these natural links courses that have been here for 100 years. America has built some copies of links courses, very good ones as well, Whistling Straits, Erin Hills. These courses, which are modern links courses, but they're still manicured to a certain extent. They've still got carries. They've still got forced carries where you have to hit the ball high. This isn't. You can get round here by hitting the ball extremely low round here. And so that's one. The weather, the inconsistency of the weather. In America, we find that wind isn't a big factor normally, unless you're at Pebble Beach in February or something. Mm-hmm. But normally around this time of year, wind isn't a factor. It is here, and you see that our weather. I mean, it's a decent country, Britain, but really, I mean, 58 degrees today, and that's summer. People think we're in the southern hemisphere, for goodness sake. This is our summer. So conditions, and I think it's all about adapting to those conditions that the American audience might not appreciate. That yes, the greens are 9 on the stimp meter. Now for golfers listening here, 9 is extremely slow. When you think of Augusta, they never tell us, but it's around about 15. US Open would be about 13. This is 9. I mean, you know, it's bordering on half the speed of Augusta, which is crazy. So it's no point in saying, oh, I left my putt short. It's a matter of, no, hit them harder. Adapt to the conditions that is given you. And if there's no wind on these courses, yes, you can do very well. And you have to adapt to those conditions to say, well, if there is wind, level par is a good score, and go for it.
Is there an extra difficulty in adapting to that, given the inconsistency of the weather? I will say this is my first time covering the Open. I made the grave mistake of actually looking at a long-term weather forecast and soon realized you just need to wake up the morning of and figure it out as you go.
We, unfortunately, in Britain can't forecast as well as you guys can. You go by street by street, don't you, in America? Your Doppler radar is unbelievable. You go street by street, highway by highway. We have a big thing called the Atlantic Ocean in our way, and we can't, unfortunately, forecast as accurately as you can. So I think you're right. I think you wake up in the morning and take what you're given. Yes, there is a forecast, but really, I mean, 50-50. It's a guesswork, what we have.
So I want to ask you about Tommy Fleetwood, because he's getting a lot of attention this week.
And rightfully so,
As a local product and a guy who snuck on to Birkdale as a kid. And just I wanted to ask about the different pressures of playing a home open and kind of what you went through at Royal Troon, especially back in 97 when you were really in peak form. And how is it different? How did you find that situation to kind of step into when the spotlight's even a little brighter than it is for a normal open?
Interesting question. I think in life, never mind in a golf term, but certainly in sports, that if you're expected to win or expected to do something, it's generally a lot harder to achieve. And when I was two in the world in 1997 at the Open, when it came to Troon, I was obviously by definition one of the favorites there. And it is difficult. You know, I think I finished 24th and okay, disappointing, but I never quite got to terms with that feeling of I should be doing better, you know, and I should be there. And I think that Tommy Fleetwood has the same pressures on him here than he's had a great time since the Masters. I think he's fourth or fifth in the world ranking since the Masters in points gained. And then coming to play your home open, you know, well, hey, you know, best of luck to you. So it's game on for him. Very difficult to achieve on your own course. Very few people come to their own courses and win. Do well, fine, but to win, I think it's almost impossible. You know, because you have this crowd support, but in golf terms, you don't always need or require that. You want to just to calm down and play your best golf away from an open on these courses, and it's most difficult. But he's performing okay today. He's doing all right.
Yep. How would you assess your playing relationship with this tournament? You had early success at Turnberry in 94. You had a runner-up at St. Andrews in 2005. Some misses in between. What, when you look back in your open career, what kind of stands out?
I think I'd have to say extremely disappointing, for someone who was one of the favorites through the 90s. I was extremely disappointed with my open performances. As you say, one top 10 in the 90s. I had to wait to 2005 to actually finish runner-up here, and that was to Woods, and you weren't beating him. So it was was disappointing. The trouble I had was, I hate to say, but I did quite well in the French, Irish, and Scottish Opens leading up to it, and therefore had to go and retain titles or defend them or whatever the case may be. And I took a lot out of myself in the end of June, beginning of July, and those three events. And unfortunately, I came to the Open and I wasn't probably as prepared as I should have been mentally and physically, because it's tiring winning mentally. And so that was the issue there, that unfortunately these big events just came beforehand. And you saw Bryson DeChambeau there winning last week in America, and the race is on to get to Birkdale to get all this stuff, and of course starts with hitting his first shot out of bounds and taking seven at the first par four. So you know, you blow yourself out the tournament immediately, and that's what I found. I was tired more mentally than anything else coming into the Open, and I just couldn't take off the Scottish Open. I couldn't take off the Irish or French. There were big European Tour events, and it just fell at the wrong time, the Open, almost.
Yeah, I think that's interesting that, you know, winning's never a bad thing for a player, but I know that we went through this a couple years ago with Jordan Spieth with the John Deere. I know last year Jason PGA had to defend at the RBC Canadian Open in between the Open and the PGA. That's something that I don't think a lot of people look at and realize that you never want to finish second, but winning also comes with a price.
Well, it does indeed. I speak for all the people that have won a golf tournament. It's not easy. It's not easy to win a golf tournament. You go through an emotional roller coaster during a golf tournament. Even if you've won by, you know, six shots, it's still tense out there, and you do put yourself under a huge amount of pressure, and that's what winners of previous events have. The John Deere Classic, when Jordan Spieth was going for three majors in a row there, in glorious hindsight, he shouldn't have really have played there. You know?
But he still played well at St. Andrews.
But he did okay at St. Andrews. Yeah. Could he have done better at St. Andrews if he hadn't played there? You know,
one shot's a difference.
One shot, maybe. I know, yeah. Maybe, I don't know. You know, however you fly over the Atlantic, you've still got jet lag. It doesn't matter if you're in a private plane or coach on the worst airline in the world. you've still got jet lag. You still have those times where you don't feel quite right. The weather changes. You know, you come from 90 degrees at the John Deere to what, 58 here. Big differences. The grasses are all different here. And just getting into the food is different. The times that language barriers probably for people, currencies, all sorts of stuff goes on. And it does take time to acclimatize. And for those rushing over, sometimes it doesn't work.
Especially for golfers who tend to be creatures of habit.
We all are. We all are. Oh, my God. I mean, have I worn the same sweater too often because it's my lucky one, you know?
Yeah.
So how are you liking life behind the microphone now?
I'm sort of half and half here where I'm still playing competitively, obviously, on
we'll
the
get
PGA
to that part.
Champions.
We'll get to that part next.
Which is great. But at the same time, I'm enjoying it. I enjoy being a, I hate to say, an armchair critic, because we are. And to voice one's opinion is quite good, because we all have an opinion, whether it be right, wrong, or indifferent, whatever. But we all have an opinion, and it's not difficult to talk about your own game. If I was talking about tennis or rugby or cricket or were you baseball or something, well, I'd be lost. But talking about golf isn't difficult. I know the game, as do all the announcers, and it's just a matter of not getting in your own way, letting the pictures tell the story a lot of the time, as opposed to overdoing the commentary. Radio is different because you've got to paint the picture, but television, you don't. And you just got to let the pictures tell the story. Sometimes you don't have to say anything about a shot because the picture tells it all.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm learning to get the producer in my ear, you know. Let it breathe, Monty. Let it breathe, which actually means shut up, really. I mean, it means
it's
Monty,
nice.
You're saying too much, you know. And I understand that, fully. So I'm still learning at it, but at the same time, enjoying the camaraderie between the likes of working, with the likes of Nick Faldo, with great guys like Peter Jacobs and Brandel Chamblee, Frank Nobolo, great on the golf from, you know, these type of things where I'm really learning a lot from their expertise and their experiences, and hopefully they're learning a little bit from myself within the golf game itself.
Well, we are fortunate to have you in the booth this week, certainly, but as you said, you're still very competitive on the PGA Tour Champions, three major titles after turning 50. What's that been like for you to kind of get back into it? We see that often with players that try and bridge that gap from early to mid 40s to try and get to 50, and then you kind of have a reset there.
I think you're very true. You know, 46 to 50, you tend to tread water a wee bit.
Mm-hmm.
And in that way, you're not quite ready to come out to the PGA Tour Champions, which is a very competitive place to be.
Mm-hmm.
And can only get more competitive. As I get older, they get younger, you know. But this year, you're coming out with Steve Stricker, with Jerry Kelly, with Davis Love, Vijay Singh. And then you add on to the guys that I've been playing with the last few years, like Freddie Couples, Bernard Langer, Miguel Jimenez, Jeff Maggot. You know, you've got a great Kenny Perry. You've got a great set there as well. And it's amazing how competitive it is. It's all very friendly, more friendly than the PGA Tour Monday to Friday. But when the gun goes Friday morning, I tell you, game on, you know. And the sufficient rewards available that it really is a very fun place to play. I've often said that there's not the same envy out there on the PGA Tour champions. There isn't the same competitiveness, but there isn't the same envy. There isn't the same egos out there. People, you know, I hate to say, sometimes in the PGA Tour, there's a few guys that fancy themselves just a wee bit too much. on the PGA Tour champions, there isn't. And I think if somebody wins out there, the rest of the players are genuinely happy for him. They really are. Yeah. Well done. You know, great. Well played. That was terrific. I was so happy for you. You know, and it's more than a pension. It's a tour, and it's proven that 50 is the new 40 for a start. And I do believe that there's more players playing the game of golf over 50 in the world than there are under. So you know, it's an amazing place to be, an amazing place to perform in your later years. Yeah.
What do you view as the highlight moment of your career?
Highlight moment of my career was my 3 PGA championships in a row at Wentworth. Yep. On the European Tour. It's now sponsored by BMW. They call it the BMW PGA Championship. To win 3 of them, it hadn't been done before, and to come there the third time and to win it 3 times in a row was special, and especially we do something that no one else has achieved. I think that was the highlight of my playing career was the 3 PGA championships in a row, 98, 99, 2000.
Yeah. When you look back, as we said, you're in the World Golf Hall of Fame. Was there a difficulty in for you internally with squaring the accolades and the achievements of your career versus the lack of majors?
Yes, it's, you know, I take it as a positive and a bonus and a credit that you're actually asking me that type of question about, you know, you've done quite well, but you haven't won a major. Well, you know, at one time I was noted as the best player in the world not to have won a major. Well, that's okay. It's better than the second best player not to have won one. And you've got to be lucky over the 4 days. Mm-hmm. There's never a major winner stood up and said I was unlucky at that particular time or hole or whatever. I just didn't get that fortune at the end of majors where somebody did something good to beat me, as opposed to somebody doing particularly badly and handing it to somebody, which sometimes is the case in major championships. Yep. More so than actually winning it. So I've no regrets, if that's what you're asking. Absolutely no regrets at all. I've had a fabulous career, and if somebody said that I would have had the career that I've had and a Hall of Fame member, I would have said, well, wow, haven't I overachieved? Mm-hmm. because I didn't know that was going to happen. So if you do overachieve in life, wow, you know, fantastic. Yep. So yeah, I'm in a good place right now, 54 years old, playing and commentating, announcing here and happy at home, and I think it's a very important mix.
If you get one mulligan, mm-hmm. are we going back to the 18th fairway at Wingfoot?
Yes. I think that's set. I think if I have one shot again, mm-hmm. I would have loved that one. You know, after a few near misses, this was it, mm-hmm. really. 2005, I was second to Tiger at St. Andrews, and then 2006, you know, we come up and have this golden opportunity, really. The drive was, I hate to say, perfect. The next 5 shots weren't, I can assure you. But, you know, to put the drive in absolutely position A, on the right-hand side of the fairway, with a 7-iron in my hands and the pin located for a fader of the ball, those who understand what I'm talking about, mm-hmm. the fader of the ball, the pin was on the right, all I had to do was just let the thing swing in. It was actually easier to birdie the hole than it was to take double, you know, at that stage. So, you know, yeah, if there's one shot, I just caught it heavy, I caught it fat, simple as that, and I made a mess of it from there on. But it was unfortunate, but there you go. I mean, Mickelson took six that day too, yep. And we were in the same position. So, you know, and his whole career has been based about trying to win that US Open. So it was a unfortunate, but yes, to answer your question in a very roundabout way, one mulligan.
That's where we're going.
That's it.
I want to shift to the Ryder Cup. As we said, you captained the winning squad in 2010 at mm-hmm. Celtic Manor. Do you, yeah. from a U.S. perspective, we always look at the President's Cup and say that the event would be bolstered if and when the international team picks up a victory. Do you feel like
I would agree
the Ryder Cup status? It's already elevated incredibly mm-hmm. on both sides of the Atlantic, but did it benefit from the U.S. winning in the fall? You need a back and forth.
Very much. I wouldn't say back and forth, but at the same time, America needed to win that.
Yeah.
With the success of the President's Cup and the success of the American team in the President's Cup, America needed to win that Ryder Cup. We still can't believe in Europe that we'd won 6 out of 8 anyway. I mean, we'd just hang out at Medina's and all the sort of stuff that goes on. My word, you know. Even Celtic Manor, you know, one shot here or there, and it always just turned in a European favour. Of course, very difficult for me to say as a fervent European and a very proud Scot that he hears me saying that it was good for America to win the Ryder Cup. But it was, as a Ryder Cup fan, it was good. Now it makes France next year even bigger and better tournament than it would have been otherwise. Now we have to go home and we have to try and win it back again, which isn't easy. We need a half a point more now, you know, than we did before, because a tie goes to America. And the Americans, if they stick to what Davis Love and Paul Azinger did with them in this famous pod system and this famous way that they play for each other, the way that Europe has done for many years, if they stick to that philosophy, I'm not saying how to blue the Ryder Cup, believe me, but if America stick to that philosophy, America will be a very, very tough team to beat, yeah, wherever it's played.
Do you feel like the overall camaraderie on the European Tour has been one of the beneficial aspects of recent European success that, you know?
I think so. I think it's a more, although it's an individual game, we as a tour are more of a family. You know, we travel on the same planes together, we have the same courtesy cars mm-hmm. together, we stay in the same hotels, go down to the bar at night. It's more of a family feel, the European Tour, than the Americans, where a lot of it's now private planes.
Yep.
You don't see anybody when they leave the course. You don't see anybody again until the next morning. And I think that was a definite advantage for us, that we were playing for each other. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying the Americans didn't like each other, but we did.
Yeah.
We really did like each other. Yeah. You know, and it was no issue for me to hold putts for Garcia, who was holding putts for Luke Donald, who was holding putts for Harrington, Westwood. We're all doing it together to get those points for Europe.
I'll let you get out of here with two lighthearted ones. First, are you aware of the Darth Monty Twitter account, and what are your thoughts?
Yes, I am aware of Darth Monty. I think he's actually quite brilliant. I said a few of the times, you know, well, you know, all credit to somebody, all credit to somebody. So he finishes off by saying, all credit to me, you know. But for those of you on social media, it's not me. It is this guy. I've never met him. I'd love to. And he's very, very good. He knows the game, knows me as an individual, and he does a good job.
Well, there you go. And last but not least, I heard you talk about this on the broadcast this morning. Talk me into mushy peas. I've had fish and chips. I've tried them. Not totally on board, but from the American perspective, let's talk some mushy peas.
Okay, America has your garden peas, right?
Right.
That come out of a pod and fine. These peas are peas. They're just squished up. A little bit of mint is added to them, and they are actually, believe it or not, extremely tasty. And we tend to have them with our what we'd have to say our British speciality fish and chips,
mm-hmm.
right? Fish and French fries to you guys, fish and chips to us, and fantastic. Fish and chips, mushy peas, a bit of malt vinegar as well on the chips. Can't go wrong.
There you go. Good way. Now we're all set for lunch here. But Colin Montgomery, thank you again for joining us on this Golf Channel podcast. Look forward to hearing your insights all week on the Open, and we'll go have some mushy peas over there.
Well, thank you, right. So, time for mushy peas.
There you go. Thank you. I'm your host, Will Gray. This has been the Golf Channel podcast. We'll see you next time.